We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
A large statue outside the Parliament House. A large statue of Surprise, Surprise himself. Larger than life it was, and printed on it were the words of that chorus we've just sung. It was slightly different, actually. It was, "Seek ye first the political kingdom, and all things will be added unto you." When his government was overthrown, the statue was destroyed. It's no longer there. It's not all that different to a man some 2,500 years ago who had a dream of a statue. A dream of a statue that his court interpreter told him was of him, especially the gold head. Huge statue. Not very different from that man who built a statue. He built a statue which was some 90 feet high, or for those younger than me, 27 metres, whatever that means. About 9-storey building, only about 9 feet wide, so it was a long, thin pinnacle that shot up into the sky, as tall as anything that was there. Nebuchadnezzar built his statue. It seemed at the end of chapter 2 that he was God-fearing. For Daniel, having told him the dream and the interpretation of the dream, had received from the king this statement, verse 47, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery." The God of Daniel is the revealer of mysteries. Nebuchadnezzar now recognizes him as the revealer of mysteries, and it sounds as if he's God-fearing. But what does he do with the information of the great statue that represents him and successive kingdoms? He builds a statue. Gold-plated, at least, if not solid gold, presumably gold-plated, for gold-plated statues were found at that period of time, not so large as this one. Gold-plated statue he built. It may have been of himself, it may have just been a pinnacle, may have been of some gods, but he was hardly a God-fearing man. For we find within the next chapter the very people he's appointed as administrators over the province of Babylon in chapter 2, verse 49, he's now gladly throwing into the fiery furnace. Here is a strange man, isn't he? But we have a problem in that we keep on reading his conversion in. We read and people saying, "I believe in God," and we take them seriously, that therefore they believe in God. When in fact is that they believe in the supernatural, which may or may not be God. They believe there are mysteries, and they believe that some people can reveal mysteries. They believe that you possibly have some access to that God who can reveal mysteries. But there's a long way between that and serving God as God. That's a very different kettle of fish. Nebuchadnezzar believed in gods. He believed in the God of Israel being the revealer of mysteries. But Nebuchadnezzar didn't serve God. And so he built his dream statue. And he calls upon all the peoples to worship at the given signal. Now I want you to answer for me for a moment or two. What was Nebuchadnezzar up to? What was he trying to do? As you read through that chapter, what do you think Nebuchadnezzar is attempting by building this statue? There you go. You tell me. Just some of the things that you think he was doing. Trying to test out the God of Israel to see if he's really there. Comes across like that in verse 15, doesn't it? Yes, Scott? To glorify himself and his kingdom. Yes, to exercise his authority over his subjects. Partly I'm repeating them so the people at the back can hear, partly because it'll all go on the tape, you see. Yep, right. Yeah, he's testing out God's people who were not worshipping the idol. See who they were? Deal with them, yes? He's trying to establish himself as God. How? Test of political loyalty. Whether you'll do as the emperor says, yes? Provide some focal point, some common point of worship for the whole community, yes? Yes, it's a display of wealth, isn't it? Yeah? Building his ego as well as his statue, yes? Making himself eternal. Interesting thing, isn't it? It's a strange business. What's he doing? Well, part of it's caught up in idolatry, hasn't it? The statue is to be worshipped. Or what the statue represents is to be worshipped. Idolatry is a funny business. It nearly always starts off building something that represents something else, and which is an aid to worship the ultimate thing. But it nearly always gets confused up so that people start worshipping the statue instead of the thing it represents. Whenever you discuss it with somebody who's involved in idolatry, they always give the defence, I'm not worshipping the statue, I'm worshipping what it represents. But when you see them behaving, they fall down in front of the statue. And when you take the statue away, they get very upset. And when you spit upon it, they go out of their brains. And if it's only what it represents, it's kind of funny that they have such emotional attachment to the thing. It's very hard for the human psyche to separate the symbol from the reality, especially when the symbol is so impressive as this one. Idolatry is part of it, but unity is part of it. The way the story is recounted has a few strange oddities, and they're a bit peculiar in some places. One is the repetitions that go through it. The repetitions of the musical instruments, the repetitions of who turns up. And when you look at those repetitive parts, you'll notice that he's calling his whole empire together. The satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, I mean the whole box and dice. Everyone who was an anybody was there on that occasion. They are all to come together. In fact, you'll notice in verse 8, verse 7, that it's all the language. Verse 7, isn't it? All peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped. Nebuchadnezzar has a problem. In a period of some 20 or so years, his empire has stretched all over the world, and it's taken in all kinds of tribal groups. Now, we're used to the idea of large nationalities. We're used to the idea of even pluralist societies. But the ancient world wasn't used to that kind of thing. There were all kinds of tribal groups here, there and everywhere. Small little nations, peoples, language groups. But Nebuchadnezzar, once he's stretched from the Tigris-Euphrates right across to the River Nile, has taken in hundreds of different kinds of nationalities all under his one empire. And unless he's very careful, the whole thing will just split apart. In fact, that's what happens to him, as it happened to the Greeks, as it happened to the Romans. It happened to each of the ancient empires. To hold it together was almost impossible. And so what he is doing is setting up a religion that involves everybody to be united in the one act, in the one common statement of unity. And he's getting all the leaders of all the different nationalities, all the language groups together to be united in this great one religious expression. It is a national empire religion, and its aim has to do with unity, with uniting the peoples. Now, of course, that has a symbolic importance for the Old Testament too, because when were the peoples of the world ever divided? When were the peoples of the world divided? The Tower of Babel, which is at exactly the same place. And what was the Tower of Babel but a huge building that reached up to the heavens by which men can come to God and which would unite the whole of mankind? And it's in the process of building that that God divides mankind so that they won't set themselves up as God. And now, in the very place, hundreds and hundreds of years later, you find the man who is going to build the world religion, the one religion for every peoples. And it's a marvellous piece of religion, you see, because it relies upon idolatry, power, culture, worship. It's marvellous because it's contentless. It's mindless. It's empty of any meaning. That's the best way of uniting people. We all agree upon nothing. No one can disagree upon a nothing, can they? And you have to be particularly perverse to disagree on nothing. And so we're all agreeing on nothing. That's the unity. Here is the big statue. When the orchestra strikes up, down we go in front of the statue. What is the statue? The statue is the thing we fall down in front of when the music strikes up. Why do we fall down in front of the statue? Because the king said to. Because the music's playing. It's meaningless. You're not even told what the statue represents. You're not told it represents a god. You're not told it represents Nebuchadnezzar. What does it represent? It represents the thing that is going to unite all the peoples. That's what it represents. It's marvellous religion. This is really good, high quality stuff. This is like the Church of England. The whole nation, you see, can come together as believing the same thing, provided you never spell out what you believe. Because as soon as you start spelling out what you believe, then some people aren't going to believe that. So the essence of a good nationalistic religion is to make sure that you don't have to believe anything. When you've got a religion where you can believe anything and everything, then you can get together with people. I used to go to the Fellowship of Biblical Studies at Sydney University. They read learned seminars of papers to each other. And we used to, people from all kinds of religious backgrounds and non-religious backgrounds even, really, used to gather together at the beginning of, we gathered together in one of the common rooms over in the Union Building there. And we would start, because they thought it was a religious activity and not just an academic activity, we should start with prayer. Now, what do you do with a group of people who come from every religious persuasion who want to pray together? Well, it was very simple. We spent 1 minute in silence. And that was an expression of our unity. Perfect expression of our unity, you see. It's the only thing we could be united upon. We could all agree to shut up for a minute. The only thing we had in common. Because as soon as we spoke, we disagreed, so there was no way we could ever actually get together or anything else. So, now, we didn't have Nebuchadnezzar. If we'd had Nebuchadnezzar, it would have been easier. We'd just stick a statue up there, play the music, and away you go. We're all worshipping together the same nothingness. That is the character of nationalistic religion. It's to unite people. But of course, the essence of uniting people is that you mustn't have any kind of perverse person who's going to not play the game. Who's going to start talking during the minute's silence of prayer. That's not on, is it? Once he starts doing that, that is the one taboo, the one faux pas, the one non-acceptable form of behaviour, is to actually do what you're told not to do, or not do what you're told to do in order to establish the unity. That's the key element. And so there's this great exercise of power. If anybody fails to fall down at the music time, into the fiery furnace. We can't accept him. He's unacceptable. He's intolerable. Got to be exterminated. So the one thing that you mustn't do is go against the stream, go against the tide. You must do what everyone else does. And so power comes into it. But the whole thing's an exercise in power, the gold and the wealth of it, the fact that all the emperors, the satraps, the judges, the treasurers, they're all there in the front rows falling down in front of everybody else. If they're falling down, we've got to go too, haven't we? The whole thing's a massive demonstration of who is king in this land. Wouldn't be hard to work it out. And of course, what we need is music. Music is such a marvellous, mindless activity, isn't it? There is the content, the real solid content of a totally mindless religion, music. Because we can all agree upon music. Very simple, just play it. Away you go. Very simple, you see. Music's a marvellous nonsense. And so by high culture, and that's why you go to such lengths, you see, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipes, the horn, all kinds of musical instruments. Every kind of music that we can go with. Away we blast in this marvellous orchestra. You and I take for granted orchestras, but this is one of the great first orchestras of the ancient world. This is an incredible exercise in culture that is used. Now, that is the character of national pop religions. All full of that kind of architecture, wealth, pomp, display, music, ceremony, and no content. Nothing. You go into resplendent church buildings, old, eerie, weird musical instruments, playing out strange noises, give you goosebumps up the back of your neck because of the eerie quality of it. Because music can do that to you, can't it? It can make you feel kind of as if something is happening, something strange, something unworldly can be happening, especially the way some people play it. It can have this effect upon you. And there you go with all the pomp. All the great ones come in one after another. The governor general, the prime minister, the premier. They're all there. They're all bowing down at the right appropriate moment at the right time. And the soldiers are there. And the king himself is there. Everything is happening. I mean, it's like Westminster Abbey, isn't it? Like watching the prince and princess getting married. It's like that, those incredible funeral scenes for the Earl Mountbatten. Remember those incredible scenes? Anybody who was anybody in royalty across the... They're all there in pomp and splendour and grandeur. All there in this tremendous religious ceremony, which actually had no content in it. The very ideas that were being expressed were all couched in an old language that you couldn't understand. The readings contradicted the sermon. It was all meaningless. That was the character and essence of it. Because once you started saying things, once you started making a definite point of view, then the nation that was being unified by this religious activity would be divided. It would defeat the very purpose of it. So we've got to keep the trumpets blaring. We've got to keep the choir robed and singing in full gusto. We've got to have an organ voluntary. We've got to have the soldiers and the guards and the carriages out the front. And we've got to have the television cameras whirring. And we've got to keep it all together in a big religious fervour. Because that way everybody can be pulled together at this moment of national crisis. Here is the culture worship. The Christmas service. The carols by candlelight kind of gathering. Went to carols by candlelight down at the barracks this year. Marvellous time. Some of our friends were down there playing, I guess. It was a great time. It was very enjoyable. We should get together a party of us and go down there. This coming Christmas, I'm sure they'll be having it on again. They're not having it on again? Yeah, they'll be having it on again. It's a great time. We should all get down there. Maybe we should go around handing out tracts or something and tell people about the meaning of Christmas. Of course, it's a very interesting exercise in community. Well, you wouldn't want to do that. It's the time when everyone's living in peace and goodwill. The last thing they want to hear about is Jesus. And that wouldn't be on, would it? I mean, we want to sing the glories of Santa Claus. He's very important because we can all agree on Santa Claus, can't we? We all know he's not there. We all know he's a nonsense. We all know he's a myth, and therefore we can believe on him with real fervour. No one's going to get upset by that. Then that's not going to cause any division, is it? You see, the one person who's totally unacceptable is the man who writes the graffiti against Santa Claus that's appeared in the last few years or so. He's the only unacceptable person. Because that is the one great myth you must not attack, is Santa Claus. I mean, why be hard on the kids? Isn't it lovely? Isn't it a wonderful thing to tell them lies each year? Isn't it important to teach them materialism? I mean, how will Christmas survive if we don't train the next generation in materialism? We must teach the Santa Claus myth. It unites us. Why, even some of my Jewish friends believe in it. I mean, why not? Anybody and everybody can believe in Santa Claus. Of course, he's a nonsense. But you talk about Jesus. You talk about Jesus as being God. You talk about Jesus as God come to earth to die for salvation of mankind. You talk about Jesus. The Australian community is not going to hold together. People are going to be set in opposition to each other. And, well, what's religion? Religion's supposed to be getting everybody together, isn't it? The one man who stands out is unacceptable and intolerable in the kind of national religion that Nebuchadnezzar is trying to establish. But notice that Nebuchadnezzar's religion is godless. It is totally godless. There's no God. Which verse shows you there's no God in Nebuchadnezzar's religion? Sorry? Yeah, verse 15 does, loud and clear, doesn't it? Look what he says there in verse 15. You'll be thrown into the fiery furnace, and then what God will be able to rescue you out of my hand? You're going about gods. You've got to deal with me. There's no God who can deal with me. It's totally godless, isn't it? Nebuchadnezzar is sure that his action is the last word, and that no God could actually reverse what Nebuchadnezzar is going to do. And so it really is a laying down of the gauntlet to the God of heaven and earth when he says there, then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? Just one other thing that I'd like to point out to you that Nebuchadnezzar is up to is that he is still a fearful tyrant, as most tyrants tend to be, terrified all the time. Notice the fury in verse 13 and verse 19. The rage, the anger, at three men in his whole empire. Three little men, he hadn't even noticed them until someone had pointed it out. Three little men who were doing nothing else than just standing up when the music played, instead of kneeling down when the music played. Three men who are just willing to be different. And the emperor is losing his temper. Why do people lose their temper like that? I mean, he was so big and powerful, he couldn't have cared about three men. Except the man who is as powerful as Nebuchadnezzar lives all his life in fear and terror. Nobody is so anxious about their money as a very wealthy person. Always the most anxious person. And no one is more terrified than a very powerful person. Do not be deceived. We are fearful of people in power and wealth and might and significance, and fearful because we... I bet you, poor old Shadrach, Meshach, they were shaking at their feet. I bet there was not one bit of their stomach that could be held still for any more than half a second. I reckon they were in dreadful state, weren't they? Worse than morning sickness, I would think, the state of their tummies. But old Nebuchadnezzar's not feeling so crash-hot either. He's in fear of them and they are a nothing. At least their fear of him is rational. Throughout this chapter then, something is said about idolatry, which I think we need to say generally, because idolatry comes up over and again in the Bible and over again in the history of religion. And I'm sorry to say, in the history of Christianity. So here are just 5 points about idolatry before we look at something that's very important about what happened in the situation. Idolatry is the place where the Christians here draw the line. Remember in chapter 1 they drew the line on the subject of eating at the foods at the king's table. But they didn't draw the line at learning the ancient mystical secret arts of the magicians of Babylon, but they did at that point. Here's another occasion when their conscience is being called upon to change and they say, no, this far, no further. And the people of God will always be doing that kind of thing, drawing the line and saying, no, I can't go any further. I mean, that marvellous movie, The Chariots of Fire, that took up a couple of years ago, one of our brothers of a previous generation who drew a line on the subject of his running on a Sunday. Very interesting, because later in his life, of course, he did run on a Sunday. He played or refereed soccer matches on a Sunday, actually, when he was a prisoner of war in China, rather, a Japanese prisoner of war. different day, different situation, he drew a different line. Very hard for people to understand that who are outside of Christianity. But we can understand the idea there comes a point at which you say, thus far and no further. That's it. Now, why an idolatry? Why would you draw the line there? Well, because, firstly, God's image in the Bible is Jesus. That is the image of God. He is the image of the invisible God, as was read for us in Colossians chapter 1. God creates man in his image. And the man is Jesus, who is the perfect image of God. What image are you going to make of God? What statue, what artwork, what stained glass window, what picture can you ever make that will truly represent God? There is none. For it'll always be less than a man, and it'll always be less than Jesus, and therefore it will always be a misrepresentation of God, not a representation of God. Whatever it is you build, whatever it is you draw, it is not what God is like. God is spirit. Those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. Any representation is a misrepresentation. If you want to see God, then you must look to the person Jesus. That is where you see God. And so throughout the scriptures, you'll find idolatry, statue making, is always condemned and ridiculed, made fun of. They speak about those idol makers. They chop down a piece of wood. They chop down what they're going to worship. They chop down a piece of wood. Then they carve it out, and with half of the wood, they light a fire and cook their tea. And with the other half, they fall down and worship it. How stupid. They actually make feet on it, says the psalmist, so as to make sure it won't move. The last thing you want is a God that could move. Very inconvenient, a God that could move. I mean, he might actually move on you, mightn't he? And so they make one that is purposely dead, lifeless, still. And it is utterly stupid. It can't speak. And that is what they worship. The early church fathers, of course, have that marvellous line that even the birds know better what to do with the statues than men. Men drop down in front of it. Birds just drop. In the Ten Commandments, two commandments are given over to this very subject. In Exodus 20, you find that God says, "You shall have no other gods before me, no other gods before me." The gods of the ancient world, except the God of Israel, was always represented in idolatry, always represented in statue and artwork. You're not to have any, says the God of Israel. And secondly, you're not to make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or in the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. You're not to make them or worship them. Neither is to take place. Not to do it in any way. A very strong prohibitions. Two out of the Ten Commandments, 20% of the commandments, are on the subject of idolatry and is dead set against it. But yet people say, oh yes, but that's saying we're not to have statues of Baal. That's true, it's saying that. It's not saying we're not to have statues of Yahweh. And anyway, I'm not really worshipping the statue, I'm only worshipping Yahweh that is represented in the statue. You remember that while Moses is up getting the Ten Commandments, the people get a bit tired of him being up there and waiting to come down, so they make a golden calf. You remember that account, don't you? And in the making of the golden calf, they fall down and worship that golden calf, and it's because of that that they are so heavily condemned by Moses when he returns. Who are they worshipping when they worship the golden calf? They're worshipping the calf, it says, yes, but they're also worshipping Yahweh, whom the calf represents. So Aaron says, when he built an altar in front of the calf, tomorrow there will be a festival to Yahweh. And so the next day the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings, and afterwards they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. Whose party was it? It was Yahweh's party. Whom were they worshipping? Yahweh. And whom were they representing in the bull? Yahweh. Oh no. They were worshipping Yahweh, but they were using a statue, and that is what is utterly repulsive to God. Don't go on with this nonsense of a distinction between worshipping the reality and not the symbol. That's not on. God says, I don't want to be represented like that. Now, my friends, If someone was to do your portrait, to make your statue, you know, carve it out in front of you, would you be pleased if the unveiling came and there in front of you was a bull? What would you think they're saying about you? What kind of impression would you have of their relationship with you? Now, if you're not so keen on being represented as a bull, why do you think God is? How on earth can you think God is going to be pleased that you've captured his spirit, the real essence of him, in a bull? It's a nonsense, isn't it? That's more than a nonsense. It's a blasphemy. It is totally and utterly unacceptable to God. Always. For the true representation of God is the man Jesus Christ. Now, Christians, of course, love art. And there's nothing wrong with art as such. But they want to include art in their buildings. And at first they do it just for educational purposes. You know, we'll have scenes from the life of Jesus that will remind us so that we'll be able to be taught. But then as those scenes are there year after year after year, people say, well, you need those kinds of things to pray in this building. That's not right. And we need other things like crosses or fish signs or things like that to let you know that it's a Christian building and a Christian meeting. I used to conduct a service in a so-called Christian school. As those scenes are there year after year after year, people say, well, you need those kinds of things to pray in this building. That's not right. And we need other things like crosses or fish signs or things like that to let you know that it's a Christian building and a Christian meeting. I used to conduct a service in a so-called Christian school. And they didn't have a chapel big enough for the school, so we used to do it in the assembly hall. And in the assembly hall of this school, the principal always insisted if we're going to run a church service there that we had to get the cross out of their little tiny chapel and stick it up on the platform behind me, because unless you had the cross up there, it wasn't a church service. I gave them the option. They could have me or the cross, one or the other. They couldn't have both. That's a very hard choice, isn't it? To think about one long and hard. Which would you prefer, the cross or Philip? You can't have both, though, for me, because if that is only a church because we've got a cross there, then the mark, the truth, see, it's an idol, isn't it? You're saying we cannot pray to God unless the cross is there. You can't be close to God unless you're inside a God box with a true sign. What is the true sign of a Christian? What is the mark of a Christian? Well, you tell me what's the mark of a Christian. What's the sign of a Christian? That's right, John 13:35. Jesus said, by this will all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. That is the mark of the Christian. It's not a cross worn around your neck. It's not a fish bag on your sign or a dove on your hat. That's not a sign of being a Christian. That's a sign of being gullible for the religious bickerback industry. I'm sorry, I cannot see anybody with a cross around their neck at the moment or a fish sign on their thing. And I know it's all very uncomfortable when I speak like this because you feel like you just need to do up your top button here for a moment so no one else will notice what you're wearing, you see. But if I never say, if I've got to wait till no one's got one on, I'll never say it, right? If you want to wear that around your neck, you wear that around your neck. A pig's tooth, a shark's tooth, a cross, they're all the same, really. None is no more Christian than other. A building's not a Christian building because it's got a cross on it. A car is not a Christian car because it's got a fish sign on the back of it with Brian written in the middle. That doesn't make the thing any more godlike or Christian. And you don't become a Christian because you've got some kind of jewellery like Mr. Ray hanging around your anatomy. Mr. T, rather, in the A-team. Mr. Ray, Mr. T. How do you know Mr. T is a Christian? Not because he wears all that junky stuff. Any twit can do that. In fact, you could hang that around your bull, couldn't you? Make a Christian bull with a big cross hanging around the neck. One of those trendy ones with a loop at the top. You make a Christian bull that way. How do you know? By the love for his fellow believers. His testimony to Jesus. That would be the indication, but not by the stuff you wear. It's a great nonsense. Get the mark of the Christian right. The image of God is Jesus. The mark of the Christian is the love he has for the brothers and sisters. In other words, what Christianity is an authentic, real, living experience. It's not religious symbolism. That's not what it's about. I know that's much more comfortable. It's much easier to accept. The society loves it. Why? The Historical Society, the Heritage Trust, think we're wonderful that we keep this building here. They love us for that. They just don't want us to do anything in it or to it. Because this represents our Christian heritage. Old, moribund, leaky, hopeless. This represents what we really stand for. Otios. Irrelevant. Of bygone day. This is the symbol that they want to keep. Not changed people. And so what aids can we use for worship? None. Other than the person of Jesus. He is the way to God. He and he only is the way to God. You don't get closer to God by getting in this kind of... If you've got a drip coming down on top of you, then just get up and move. We all understand why people are moving at the moment. It's got to do with the fact they're being dripped on. Except the front row, they're being spat upon. You don't get closer to God. You don't get closer to God by moving into a building like this and having the eerie organ music going and the stained glass windows with all the blokes with saucers behind their heads, except for the one up here. It's marvellous, got trumpets coming out his ears. I was in a church building this morning where Jesus is actually saying, "I caught one that big." Extraordinary. You want to check out Little St. Barnabas at Mill Hill Road. Jesus down there has just caught a fish. Little tiddler it is. Huh? You don't get closer to God that way. If you want to get closer to God, stand in the middle of Oxford Street. That is the way to get close to God. Close your eyes and just stand there. You will come to meet him very soon. But coming in here is fairly safe. You're secluded and kept from God. Right, the buildings don't get you close to God. There's no aid to worship. People keep on thinking there'll be ways of getting there. If I just sit in the corner and adopt this posture and do this and do that, and I can somehow... But it's never on. Jesus is the one and only way to God. You come through him, or you don't come at all. There are no aids to worship. But idolatry down the centuries has really racked Christian movement. In the early years, there was very little idolatry. One of the characteristics we have of the early centuries was that Christians were blamed and accused of being atheists. Because when people ransacked their church buildings, they couldn't find any idols, and therefore they couldn't find any gods, and therefore they must be atheists. Christians were accused of three things in the early centuries, in the second century. They were accused of incest, of cannibalism, and atheism. Now for us, we find that very hard to understand, don't we? But ponder it, friends. Here are a group of people who keep on eating and drinking the body and blood of their Lord. Very sus, isn't it? Cannibalism. And although they call everybody brother and sister, they'll only marry each other. Incest. And when you go into their buildings, there are no gods to be seen anywhere. No statues, no idols. Atheists. It's not until the 4th and 5th century that the Christians start to have statues. And then in the 8th century, there is an incredible fight that takes place when the emperor says no to the icons, and the whole iconoclastic movement is established. And for 150 years, there's this warfare waged on the subject of whether or not to have icons, until Empress Theodora in 843 declared the Feast of Orthodoxy, the first Sunday in Lent, when icons were to be an established part of Christian tradition. And it's not till the Reformation that you have anybody questioning again the statues. And the great glories of the Cromwellian years when they ripped them out of the churches of England and closed down some of the more useless god boxes that lived over there and declared them for the idol boxes that they were. Of course, if you go on the tour now, the National Trust and the Heritage Commission over there will all tell you what tut tut, shame, shame, dreadful thing that Cromwell did, parking his horses over there, which is actually historically inaccurate. He didn't. Parking his horses over there and whopping off the heads of this statue and that statue and all the rest of it. But then again, remember, those people aren't actually interested in Christianity. They're interested in antiquity. They're interested in beauty and art. And I'm all for them. Let them be interested in antiquity. Let them be interested in beauty and art. Let them pay for it. But why should the cause of the gospel of Jesus Christ be held up by paying for buildings that are totally counter to the very message we're proclaiming, that the way to God is not through statues, but through the person of Jesus Christ? Enough of the brief history. Notice the marvellous thing that happens here in verse 17. The incredible faith of the three men. Really is a staggering statement, isn't it, they make there. Our God's able to do it, and he will rescue us. Now, we know that their faith is a vindicated faith, don't we? They get out of the fiery furnace. That's a fairly good vindication. Nobody I've ever met has ever questioned, from the account given to us here, that these are three goodies. What they did and what they stood for was right. Even old Nebuchadnezzar could work out that what they did was right. Everybody can work out that. Their faith in God was vindicated. But don't you think their faith in God sounds presumptuous in verse 17? God is going to do it. Now, I wish to express some considerable reservation at the moment about the heresy of presumptuous faith. I call it a heresy because last Friday night I preached on it and people actually got the impression I was saying I was for it. So I've got to be careful not to be too sarcastic and cynical, because I can misrepresent myself totally. I'm against this. Presumptuous faith. But it is being taught a lot today. People are being taught that what you've got to do is claim things from God. You've just got to presume that God will give it to you, and if you doubt at all, then that's because you don't have faith, and that's why you're not getting it. So you're sick? All right, pray to God for healing. Believe wholeheartedly he'll give it to you, and it's yours. And the reason why you continue to be sick is because you don't believe wholeheartedly. You're not just telling God to make you better. That's what you've got to do. You've got to say, God, you want people to be well. I am sick. Make me better. Thank you. And if I feel any twinge of sickness, I've got to say, no, it's the devil tempting me to think I'm still sick. Not true. I'm not sick anymore. I am better because God cures. And I mustn't doubt a bit, because God is going to cure me. That's not only healing ministries, it's all kind of ministries. There's an organisation that has this about fundraising. You often hear it in churches, actually. People, when they're desperately short of money, they say, we believe that God will give us this money. God has to do it. We mustn't lose faith at this point. I know an organisation, though, that actually does it about missionary funding. You go out there to the airport, you get your passport, you get all your bags, and you sit there saying, I know God wants me on the mission field, and if God wants me on the mission field, he'll provide the wherewithal to get there. So I'm ready, I'm willing, I've got my passport, I've got my bags, I'm at the airport, send me the man with the ticket. And I just got to believe. I know a woman who stayed out at the airport for 3 or 4 days, believing that God was going to send someone with the money to buy the ticket to go. 3 or 4 days in an airport. That's worse than a fiery furnace. Very, very discouraging when after 3 or 4 days hadn't come. Very difficult. Because on the basis of presumptuous faith, to pack up and go home is to lack faith, isn't it? So you see the bind you're in now. I've got to stay here. Because if I don't stay here, I don't have faith. But if I do stay here, I'll be here the rest of my life. What do I do? What do you do when you're not getting better? David Watson, a great English evangelist, preacher of this century in England, died a couple of years ago of cancer. After 3 of the great faith healers of the world had visited and told him that he was definitely cured. All you have to do is believe it now. The words come, you're better. Presumptuous faith. But doesn't that exactly sound what they're saying? God will rescue me. All I've got to say is get up, be cast in the sea. There it goes, mountain number 34. However, I believe that what is appropriate for Christians to say is, if it be God's will. Remember the Lord Jesus Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane? Lord, you can spare me from death. Spare me from death. Nevertheless, not what I want, but what you want. Not my will, but your will be done. And so although he asked God to spare him of death, God said no and sent him to death. Because he wanted God's will, not his will. That is God-fearing faith. It's not telling God what to do, it's asking God. It's saying, God, you're in control. You know better than I do. You do what's best in this situation. I trust you for what's best. And it may be not what I want, but ultimately I want what you want. Of course, look at verse 18, and you'll see theirs was not presumptuous faith. Theirs was God-fearing faith, wasn't it? God is able to rescue us from you, Nebuchadnezzar. Rescue us from the fiery furnace? Sure, he'll do that. And even if he doesn't, see, they don't sound too sure, do they now? They don't know they're going to be rescued. Even if he doesn't, we don't care, we're still not going to bow down to your silly old statue. Verse 18 is a marvellous statement of God-fearing faith. Not presumptuous faith at all. If you've got no clear word from God what he is going to do in the future, then you can only ever say, if it be God's will. And those people who are now writing and preaching, as it is frequently you'll come across, which says ever to say, if it be your will, is a lack of faith, have got Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego to account for, haven't they? Because that's exactly what they did. And even Nebuchadnezzar could see their faith was right. They've got Jesus to counter with. Because his faith was a suffering at the hand of God. I conclude by turning to 1 Peter chapter 4 for a minute. Somewhere along the line of life we've run ourselves short on time, and so we won't do a public question time, but I'll be here at supper. You grab me. 1 Peter 4 verse 19, that'll do. Look at it in its context later. For the sake of time now, I'll just do it on the one verse. So then, those who suffer according to God's will, suffer according to God's will. Notice the phrase, friends? Because there are people now who are saying, if you're suffering, it's because you're outside of God's will. You're doing something wrong. You haven't got enough faith or something. But here, it's referring to people who suffer according to God's will, like Jesus who suffered according to God's will, like Paul or Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus suffered according to God's will, like Timothy who suffered with a sick stomach suffered according to God's will. Those who suffer according to God's will, those who are being persecuted, for example, are suffering according to God's will, not because they're sinners, not because they're thieves and things like that, but because of the gospel of Jesus. Those who are suffering by God's will, what should you do? You live in a pagan world, you live in a world that's hostile to Christianity, it's going to cause difficulty and problems as you actually say, look, I'm really not interested in Santa Claus. As you raise your hand and say, I'd prefer the children at schools to be taught about Jesus and his death and resurrection at Easter time rather than taught about Easter bunnies at Easter time. As you actually stand out against the culture around about you, as you live differently, you're bound to be put into persecution and difficulty, what should you do? Well, 1 Peter 4:19 tells you, those who suffer according to God's will should commit themselves to their faithful Creator, just like the men there in Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. Don't know about you, Nebuchadnezzar, don't know about your statue, but I'm going to do what God says to do, irrespective. Should commit yourself to the faithful Creator and continue to do what is good. He may rescue you, he may not. Many a Christian has died in the flames, eaten by the lions, spiked through, shot dead, bashed and beaten, many, many. God didn't rescue them, not because they didn't have faith in him, but because it was his will and purpose at that time. And they did have faith in him. He may rescue, he may not, but in between time, what you should do is trust him and do what's right. And that can never be to bow the knee, to nod the head,
to wink the eye, or to scratch the chin to the idol. It's to stand erect and to say, that is false. Our God is nothing like that. Our God is Jesus. And he is the one with whom you have to do. Let's pray, shall we?
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.